Getting very tardy this morning. Never mind. Weather today, highs of 10 degrees centigrade, lows of 7 degrees centigrade, a breezy morning with sunny spells, but variable amounts of cloud.
Prime ministers and presidents may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions remains.
And it's time for Ian Lennox's Tall Tale, the Ian Lennox Jackanory feature, where Ian will share the story with us, which we've been waiting for so many minutes, during which time we've done four documentaries at least. Welcome back, Ian Lennox.
It's a very short story, probably worthy of a 30-second documentary.
Nice.
But never mind. Anyway, I had a text from one of my friends who'd been up to Anak, and he'd gone into a shop called Barter Books. I say a shop, it's a second-hand bookstore. It's one of the biggest in the country, I think. And basically, these people took over Anak railway station, and as they expanded, they went deeper and deeper into the platforms, and they've now got thousands and thousands of books. It's quite a famous... It's opposite Anak Castle, home of the Harry Potter movies, as you know.
I don't think Hannah has any interest in this whatsoever, but never mind. Anak, Hannah, and Harry Potter?
Anak. No.
She doesn't have... She's not a real fan, really.
But it doesn't matter. Anyway, he sent me a text saying the Barter Books... I have a copy of my first novel on sale for £9.60. And he said, and apparently the reason for this was that it was signed. The price hike, you know, which is about twice what it was. I put onto Facebook that I hadn't the heart to tell them that the unsigned copies were rarer.
Phenomenal. You know, the crowd going quite literally crazy on that story. The delivery of Ian Lennox, the signed or unsigned author tale based in Anak, where, of course, as we know, many of the Harry Potter movies were actually shot and developed. And just, you know, tremendous. What a way to actually start the second hour of this particular
I didn't know you had a cast of thousands in here.
For you, Ian, they've just come to actually emerge and...
They flock outside.
Exactly, they've been gathering.
Outside the window,
gathering together.
Sea of people screaming your name.
Quite a... Okay. It's exactly, along with lines such as, build the wall, and other... Other classics, you know, it's great stuff. We'd mention some of John Wenham's wonderful material. And shall we consider the Lincoln Drill Hall, Natasha?
I don't know, Alex, shall we?
Okay. Lincoln Drill Hall, Thursday the 23rd of February. That's a week today at 7:30 p.m. The eulogy of Toby Peach. Toby has come to deliver his eulogy. And you can join Toby as he enters the not-so-elusive Cancer Club. Sample chemotherapy cocktails, select the perfect funeral playlist, and marvel at Willy Wonka's life-saving stem cell machine. From diagnosis to remission, relapse, and treatment, experience a young man's journey with cancer in this honest and inspiring exploration of modern science and the human body. Toby has been quoted as saying, I was born on the 18th of December 1988. I was diagnosed with cancer 3,322,000 minutes ago. Tickets £12, concessions £10, students £8, and inquiries to the Lincoln Drill Hall as ever, 01522 873894. Yeah, I know. Interesting. Yeah, there's an interesting line on that. You kind of have one of those moments where you think, really? Seriously? Is that? But, you know, it's postmodern. That's what I say. It's postmodern. Could be good to have a documentary on it. Ian's probably dropped the telephone up in Newcastle. That's the same thing. Anyway.
Well, no, I wasn't. I thought it was off now.
Well, yeah, actually, it is time for Hannah to put those last two questions to you. So
right.
Off you go, Miss Brown. Please deliver with aplomb.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, I have, thank you.
And will you be joining us again soon?
I hope so. I hope to win more applause from Alex.
Well, you know, who knows when the spirit is moved, how the spirit is indeed moved. No,
Now, clearly, regular listeners to the Midweek Drive, and indeed Inspired On Air, will be well aware of the delights of our regular Starburst correspondent, Ed Fortune, who was eulogising and continues to eulogise about the 2016 winner of the Arthur C. Clarke Award. Quite rightly, an outstanding text, Children of Time. And when we actually add to that the notion of the tiger and the wolf, and the upcoming The Bear and the Serpent, and a whole heap of other goodies, you've clearly got a legendary author in every sense of the word. We're delighted to actually have a few words now ahead of his upcoming visit to Lincoln. It's the amazingly talented Adrian Tchaikovsky. How are you, Adrian? Excellent. Good to connect with you. Good stuff. Adrian, science fiction and fantasy and science fiction, it's a debate that's continued long across the ages and so on, and will probably continue into the 21st century. I've read both. I thoroughly enjoyed Children of Time. That was my first introduction to your work. In the words of Peter F. Hamilton, this is really smart science fiction. And then, of course, ahead of the upcoming launch of The Bear and the Serpent, I thought I'd have a look at The Tiger and the Wolf, which again goes into that wonderful world of kind of fantasy come totemistic scenario. Or is it perhaps just a case, Adrian, that you're using Arthur C. Clarke's law himself, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic?
I think The Tiger and the Wolf is fairly solidly magic.
Yeah, that's that. That makes sense. The one thing that I enjoyed, let's talk about the Tiger and the Wolf. You kind of channel a whole range of aspects within that. And I was interested to find, is that tying into your own biological background? Because clearly, you know, you've got psychology and zoology at the background there. So this whole notion of inner spirits and totems, presumably, they kind of permeate the whole narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated by the animal world in general, and I was kind of raised on David Attenborough when I was a kid, and I think that's fed hugely into all of my work, whether it's the spiders and Children of Time, or whether it's all of the various sort of animal shape-shifting tribes in The Tiger and the Wolf.
Looking towards that, of course, the other aspect is clearly you were born in Woodall Spa in Lincolnshire. So headed off to Reading from that point of view. Now you're actually based in Leeds from that perspective. It's quite an interesting shift because obviously the fantasy science fiction elements, I mean, obviously we've got other elements that have actually come through. Where would you highlight? I mean, is Children of Time probably one of your kind of first hard science fiction ones? Or was that something where you were looking, you know, again, at looking at, I mean, I can only describe both of them as epic texts.
Children of Time is really my first real science fiction of any type. Everything previous to that has been fairly solidly in the fantasy camp.
I mean,
I'm building on that success. I've got some more science fiction coming up in the next year or so.
Excellent. We certainly look forward to that. I mean, any chance of continuing the development of the arachnids versus the humans, and the humans and the arachnids, and so on?
Well, I'm kind of collecting ideas for a sequel now. I mean, the difficulty is, I think, especially given the very, very positive reception the book got, it would have to be a sequel worthy of the original. And so I'm looking for just the big ideas to tie it together. But I've always had other things I wanted to look at in the uplift sense, other kind of species outlooks to have a go at.
I certainly got a sense of almost a dynasty style Joan Collins versus Linda. Battle in terms of Alexis Carrington and various other things, where we were thinking about Portia and Bianca. I could see Portia and Bianca effectively sort of being characters in Dynasty from the 1980s TV series and going head to head, really, the sort of Machiavellian twists of that. But that's another line. Let's talk briefly, because obviously we'll be talking more when you're in Lincoln, and a reminder that's coming up on Saturday, the 18th of February, at Linden Books. So we'll be duly delighted to connect with you there and all sorts of other areas. But let's talk a little bit about the prequel, of course, too. I say the prequel, either the first in the trilogy of books with respect to the Four. The Bear and the Serpent is upcoming, but The Wolf and the Tiger. Got to be honest, Adrian, when I was working through this, initially I thought, oh, I don't know where we're going, but what really, to me, totally won me over 100% and almost had me in tears was the death of Hesperit, the elderly Hesperit. We weren't going to sort of do that. I thought that the you kind of took a number of characters who initially you thought, well, are you just dealing with kind of classical, almost ciphers in terms of where, you know, the kind of the evil kind of father, the thing, and Manier is obviously the plucky heroine and going off in a whole routine. But you managed to kind of, again, draw together a whole range of things. So you get that wonderful group, that disparate group, that fellowship, if you like, of characters from Manier, from obviously Broken Axe latterly, from the bear character, etc., and Hesperit and so on, and even actually the way in which Hesperit is introduced, you know, and that connection between Manier. Do you work from a kind of J.K. Rowling stance of saying, okay, I've plotted it all out now, I know exactly where Manier is going, I know all the kind of things, I know the tiger connection and all those sorts of stuff, or do you also kind of sometimes allow inspiration to strike as you're writing?
I certainly try to do the former, the latter does happen. I mean, I sort of put a plan that basically nails things down chapter by chapter, but so, I mean, so with The Bear and the Serpent, for example, I got about two-thirds of the way through and then realized that what I was wanting just wasn't really going to work. And so, you have to amend on the fly, and sometimes you just have to go back and rewrite all the chunks, which is what happened there.
It's a question I'm sure many authors are actually asked, and it can be a bit like choosing between your favourite offspring and so on. But let's talk about characters to start off with. I mean, I mentioned that I think I have a hot spot for Manny. I think she did very well. But in terms of the characters, who would be your favourite from the whole sort of sequence? Would it be Lord Thunder? Would it be the connection from that? Was there a particular species which you said, yeah, actually, I've always liked the hyenas?
I'm not quite sure why, but I do have a bit of a weird soft spot for the hyenas. I think it's mostly because they get a very bad press, and like with spiders, I quite like sort of taking a different stance on traditionally bad, traditionally sort of sinister animals. I think for chaos, so Loud Thunder is one of the most fun to read, because you spend almost the entire book perpetually confused and not really knowing what's going on.
I can understand that. I mean, I do the same with my students at the University of Lincoln. It's just all stranger things there. Can we look forward to maybe seeing some incarnations of vultures there, if we're looking at that? Because they've had a bit of a risky press, really, in terms of that. Piranhas, that's another line.
There is a vulture tribe in the third book. Ah. I've just literally submitted the manuscript of that publisher. I've not gone with... I think Fisher a bit of a... Fisher a bit of a blind spot. I think it'd be quite hard to work them in. The second book, the seal tribe, is the very pathetic as I get.
And of course, you know, presumably with popularity alone, you might be tempted to go meerkat, perhaps? Just a thought, you know. Moving on from that perspective, I'm thinking of the cinematic elements that come across here. I mean, obviously, with CGI being what it is, that notion of stepping and actually moving from one character into another and actually becoming that character. I mean, partly due to the skill, I think, in terms of the writing and the description that you actually entailed. But one certainly got that sense of the ease. This wasn't something that kind of owed itself to lycanthropy and Rick Baker special effects, where there's pain and agony and shifting. In fact, really the only agony is that undergone by Manier when we have the two battles between her inner souls of the wolf and the tiger. Other than that, it seems a relatively straightforward procedure. Was it something you were deliberately conscious of to approach a natural approach to this thing and actually ensure that, you know, as far as the reader was concerned, it was literally you just quite, you know, step into the actual soul, and it's not an even leap into it and change as a matter of thought, and the notion of instant metamorphosis is something which is kind of the classic line that sort of the book rests on.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, when you get married, it's generally an unnatural thing, and the transformation is like you said, it's quite lengthy, it can be quite painful. It's sort of someone being dragged from their human self, whereas in the Tiger and the Wolf, basically, they don't draw that distinction between selves. And the change is instant. You take everything you've got with you along for the change. And so, for example, you have quite a few fights where people are changing in and out of animal form as into whatever gives them an advantage of in that moment. And it figures in again, because it is very natural to all the people involved, because it's something that everyone can do rather than being something that marks out someone from everyone else. It pervades their culture and their religion, and one of the ways the book developed really was once I had that basic idea, it's just like, well, what would this change? I kind of led the world sort of flow organically from those basic tenets.
And it does carry with it, as I mentioned at the start, really, lots of connotations of the Native American and that spirit world. I mean, we have spirit guides that, clearly when we've spoken to our colleagues over at University of San Diego and Native American voices, Randy Reinholtz and Jean Bruce Scott, there's this notion that you have, in terms of the soul, however we define the soul, wherever it's actually based, the notion of animal companions, maybe sort of life form sharing this journey through life and existence.
Yeah, I mean, I've not based it off any specific Native American philosophy, because I think that would be rather presumptuous for me as a kind of an English white guy. But I have tried to do a world that recalls a sort of a pre-Columbian New World feel, in the same way that a lot of fantasy recalls a sort of a medieval Europe sort of feel. So it's got more of an inspiration from that, and I did a certain amount of sort of reading and research at the start.
And maybe also a bit of Jungian archetypal psychoanalysis as well can be creeping in there, but that's another thesis, perhaps. That's the we'll address that in all sorts of ways. I can't believe time is heading on. We must just remind folk that as far as wanting to actually meet you in person, I think there are just one or two tickets still available for this grand scenario. It's Saturday, the 18th of February, 7 p.m. at Linden Books when the thing takes place. I couldn't believe this, Adrian. Tickets a mere £4. That is astonishing. I would have thought you'd be at least £400. It'll happen, but and also get a glass of wine, a soft drink, etc. A chance to actually engage in conversation with the legendary, awesome Adrian Tchaikovsky. Adrian, it's been lovely for me just sharing some thoughts today with your good self. I'm certainly looking forward to the event on Saturday, the 18th of February. Clearly a Lincolnshire lad. Have you been to Lincoln recently, or is this the first visit for a long time?
No, I was in Lincoln late last year for the steampunk fair, actually.
Oh. Well, there we are. So you've seen the changes and peculiarities that take place in our fair city, then?
Yes.
Yeah, in many ways, this is the dream that actually maybe in a future text you could actually have a time device, a sort of wormhole, which would actually bring Manier to Lincoln in the 21st century. Just a thought. Could travel through time and space, perhaps. It could be a different line from that particular perspective. All the texts available. Quick plug for the website. Presumably people are going to access you online with these. I mean, and inevitably the question is, are you related to the composer?
Not to my knowledge. In Poland it's a fairly common name.
Well, listen, Alex Levchuk, Adrian Tchaikovsky, one means little lion. I haven't gone into the research for Tchaikovsky. It's all part and parcel of the rich tapestry of life that we live in, really. Adrian, it's been a genuine pleasure and a delight touching base with your good self. Really looking forward to meeting you, as I say, on the 18th of February. And I was also under instructions to pass on best wishes from some of our other colleagues, as well as Starburst writers and editors Ed Fortune. Also George Mann, an author who's taking part in a symposium that we're running towards that end of the month. He said, oh, Adrian, great author, etc., Sam Stone, etc. So clearly the magic is continuing to work its way. And we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Really wasn't sure whether Adrian Tchaikovsky was actually talking through a sock for most of that interview, but never mind. Hopefully you got the general gist of the whole thing. And if you'd like to hear him not talk through a sock, you can, of course, catch up with him at Linden Books this coming Saturday. That's the 18th of February, and it's at 7 o'clock, and tickets are mere £4, as you actually heard. Okay, We may be speaking to William Sidwell. I just don't know. I mean, he can be a mercurial individual at the best of times, really. We haven't had a confirmation as yet that he's okay, but that hasn't stopped us in the past. So we will see what happens when we try and reach William Sidwell in a matter of moments. Holly has headed off to make her documentary. In fact, she's probably going to make 30 documentaries between now and next week, because she's that kind of productive genius. But that means that Hannah and Natasha are still around. And this is Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark.
To Siren 107.3. Good morning. Time now on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for culinary class and gastronomic gorgeousness with the broadcasting legend, who is William Sitwell.
Tremendous. And he's had time to obviously celebrate the paperback launch of Eggs or Anarchy. Actually, he's not. His line's just gone dead on that particular routine. He's clearly trying to draw up and do all sorts of things. William was there momentarily. He's not there now. Five. William Sidwell, for the second time, welcome back to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Lovely. Where have you been?
Somehow the universe manifests in its glorious ways, just as it does with the paperback edition of Eggs or Anarchy, out and available now for under £10. That's amazing, yeah.
Of course. Bargain, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the Rice family, of course, won theirs because they won the bake-off competition. But Natasha, not only did you enter the competition, you are in particular delighted to be able to connect once again with the great William Sidwell for
yes.
reasons that connect with your mother.
Yes, my mother's a massive MasterChef fan, and I get the pleasure of every time you occasionally pop up of saying, "I've spoken to this person."
Exactly. You see what joy and delight, William, you've given to the Nottinghamshire household of Natasha Armstrong and friends.
Well, I live to serve.
Hannah, over to yourself. Questions for William about life, the universe, one-minute documentaries, anything really, or, of course, the paperback version of Eggs or Anarchy. Available now, the remarkable story of the man tasked with the impossible to feed a nation at war.
Ooh. Well, I've recently got some more piping decoration things for cakes for my birthday. So I was wondering if you've ever done, if you do much decorating on cakes or, you know, anything like that?
No.
not a decorating person.
In all the worlds of all the questions, asking William Sidwell about his views on piping, truly a wondrous time. Exactly.
I didn't know.
Exactly.
I'm not a baker. I'm not a pâtissier. In fact, I was talking to a woman called Sarah Barber, who is the head pastry chef of the Café Royal in London. And, you've got to have, I don't know, the right temperament. I think you're born with the skills to be a pastry chef, or you're not. I was born with the skills to eat pastry.
Okay. But I see earlier this week, when people were celebrating all manner of Valentine's Day massacre, on Soho Radio, William was speaking with Will Lyons, talking about the Soho Radio biting talk about which wines to celebrate Valentine's Day with. So did you put that into practice, William? Did you actually sort of say, yeah, we're going to celebrate with this particular wine, or did you just say, no, I'm going teetotal for the night?
Teetotal's not the colour of this week, I have to admit. But actually, I did drink some pink fizz on Tuesday night. I drank a bit of Balfour Brut Rosé, which is one of the best of this country's sparkling wines, made by a man called Richard Balfour Lynn at the Hush Heath Estate down in Kent, one of the most beautiful vineyards. And he's a phenomenal winemaker, amongst many other things. And then I haven't really stopped sipping.
Well, hopefully you're not drinking as you're cycling through the streets of London at present, because obviously that would be dangerous and possibly a little bit absurd. But, you know, at the same time, you know, we care. We want to ensure that we care and we share. Hannah, I'm not sure whether you want to talk about the traffic light party that was being shared by Holly. William, when you were an undergraduate at the University of Kent at Canterbury, did you ever come across the traffic light party syndrome?
No. Yeah. What is it?
Hannah, please.
Well, from my understanding, I didn't go, but I had seen something online about it, and Holly brought it up. Is basically, was it a T-shirt they had to wear?
No, it's full clothing.
Full outfit.
So you can either wear the different colours, obviously, green, amber, red. Of a traffic light. If you wear red, it means you are in a relationship and do not want to meet anyone. If you're amber, you're open to meeting someone, but reserve the right, you know, be like no. And if you're green, I think the wording was up for anything online when I saw it.
You see, I call me old-fashioned and borderline politically correct, but I'm thinking, I'm not sure. I mean, William, your thoughts on the traffic light scenario?
I think that sounds horribly vulgar.
Yes.
I think that the gentleman out there, the pro chevalier, as Jacob Rees-Mogg MP would have it, should show restraint, dignity at all times, and women shouldn't wear badges that say they're up for it. They should have their status gently explored and nimbly, deftly examined and investigated with huge charm before they reveal any of their intentions.
Quite right, too.
Which quite obviously, yeah. Should be up for anything.
You're listening to William Sidwell giving relationship advice here from the streets of London, somewhere in the whole. Actually, where are you cycling at present, William?
I've just arrived onto Peerless Street, which is an EC1, near my office in Shoreditch, which is by Old Street.
And one day, fingers crossed, we'll hopefully be there for a location report. They'll probably move by then, but you know, we'll see where things happen. Natasha, any further questions you want to ask the man?
Yes, actually, I was going to ask your advice, William, if that was all right. I'm currently doing a magazine about soup, which seems rather bizarre, as you can imagine. And as part of that, I was wondering what your favourite soup recipe was, or if you have a favourite soup that you think I should include, or yeah.
Well, this is a great idea. Soup is one of the great dishes that has sustained mankind for centuries. So I there's nothing strange with you doing a soup magazine. I think it's a great idea. You need to make sure you have a bread section, obviously, because you need to be able to make bread in order to be able to enjoy your soup. And then you should have a wine section as well to know what wine to drink with your soup. But as for me, the key thing is to make sure you've got stock. So when you buy a good chicken for roasting, boil the bones and then pop the stock in the fridge or the freezer, so you've always got a good bit of stock on hand. I think soup with sort of slow cook with lentils is always fantastic, but there's nothing better than a very clean, pure chicken soup. I think that's lovely. But I'm quite into sort of the idea of literally just making soup out of what you've got in the fridge. You know, some leeks, some carrots, just fry them and then just bung whatever you've got in. Pour in the stock, boil it and zhum it up with a zhummer. Have you got a zhummer?
I don't, but I may invest in one now that you've suggested that to me.
Those things that grind them up, it goes zoom, 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 zoom.
Yes, yes, yeah. yes.
and then you can either strain it through a sieve. But otherwise, it's good to, you know, if you have to have some game, you know, or boil up the bones and the flesh of partridge or pheasant and make a game soup. The other really good tip I got the other day from a wonderful chef called Henry Harris is that if you think your soup's a little bit bland, put in a few teaspoons of bovril, because that'll give it this really wonderful kind of umami texture, that wonderful je ne sais quoi that you want, that gives you a bit of extra savoury. So bovril is a really clever thing. A couple of spoons of that, and it'll transform your soup. So there's a tip.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. I'm definitely going to try all of that.
Etiquette advice, relationship advice, soup advice. There's just no end to the talents of William Sitwell. Hannah, last two questions, please.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us this morning?
Yeah, I enjoyed it more than the man that I crashed into at the crossroads while I was talking to you, but I didn't feel that. I slapped into his briefcase. He gave me a mean stare, and then I bundled off.
Lord, never mind. Carry on. I mean, I hopefully he realises just who actually smacked into him, really, because, you know, it's very important. Carry on.
Will you be joining us again soon?
I hope so, yeah.
Yay! Round of applause for William Sitwell, please! A recent survey suggests that 86% suggest that we're ruder than we used to be when it actually comes to ordering lunch. Busy Brits are forgetting basic manners when ordering lunch. And now we can acknowledge that there are a whole range of challenges with respect to this. But when Subway carried out this survey on people who go out to buy lunch whilst at work, 81% of people feel rushed to go out and buy their lunch, with over a third of people arguing that time pressure is the reason why people forget their manners. We clearly need to take a time to just step back and reflect on this and to address those issues and a few more fascinating areas. We're delighted to be able to welcome a director of Subway for the UK and Ireland. That would be the fabulous Sasha Clark. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning.
And the equally wonderful head of policy at the Institute of Customer Service, Mike Patruk. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Sasha, if we come to you first. Now, clearly, you know, we live in a very busy, speedy world where time seems to be shooting by. Were there any areas of this survey that surprised you in terms of results?
There were, actually. I was really surprised to see that a third of people feel that the rush that they have at lunchtime is actually affecting their memory in terms of simple pleases and thank yous. And interestingly enough, only 9% of people said that the reason they don't smile or say please and thank you it's because of bad service. And that's only 9%. So for me, that kind of suggests that, you know, there's an opportunity for customer service and for brands like Subway to make sure that the service that customers are receiving does something a little bit more to surprise and delight the customer, to remind them of their simple manners. And it's one of the things that we're doing on Valentine's Day to show customers how much we genuinely appreciate them and to say thank you nationally. We're having a customer appreciation day, which is where customers can receive their favourite 6-inch sub with every large drink they purchase. And it's a simple mechanic, but it's an important one to help disrupt our busy minds at that lunchtime period, and also for Subway to say thank you again to our customers.
And from a perspective, obviously, Subway putting into practice there something which, you know, we'd say, well, it's self-evident. I mean, Mike, from your perspective, you would have thought that surely if a lot more companies could adopt this, then maybe our manners would be, it would be a virtuous circle. We would say please, we would say thank you, we wouldn't say now.
You've got to hope so. The whole point is that it's a conversation, it's a two-way conversation. And if somebody wants good service, they've got to put a little bit of effort into it as well. Just the same as if somebody wants to be treated nicely from one side of the counter, they've got to be polite to the customer.
Sasha, we're often informed, or at least the general impression seems to be for a long time, that we could never match what was happening in the United States when it comes to genuine customer service and so on. Are we improving in terms of that? And do you sense that, I mean, as Mike's just said, that both sides of the equation are effectively sort of acknowledging that actually if you can be basically civil and polite, you're going to get a much happier environment all round?
Absolutely. And you asked about, you know, that mirroring of the experience and the type of authentic service that often gets showcased from a US point of view. I think in the UK and Ireland, it's important to remember that our cultural nuances is different from a US customer service standpoint. But what's important for us, for Subway, and the reason why we commissioned this service and this research, is to understand more about how our customers in UK and Ireland are actually feeling about our brand, what their level of satisfaction is, and how they're experiencing our customer service. So then we can take that back and apply it to training, apply it to our sandwich artists' service steps to make sure that we're doing the right thing by our customers and making them feel valued and enjoying their experience at Subway.
It's very significant that 96% of those surveyed would remain loyal if they experienced great customer surveys and great customer service, I should say, as opposed to surveys. That's another issue entirely. But in terms of customer service, again, Mike, from your own perspective, any surprises that emerged from this particular analysis?
For me, the biggest surprise is that a third of workers refuse to smile when they're ordering food. It doesn't take a lot of effort. In fact, it takes no effort at all. And this is why I was saying before that if people want a good level of service, if they want excellent service, they've got to put a little bit into it as well. But from the point of view of somebody offering the service, they've got to take the time to listen and then actually hear what's being asked of them, because it is about having a two-way conversation. It is about building a relationship. And as you've suggested as well, being good is no longer good enough. It's about being excellent. It's about having the right skills. And it's about delivering a fast, efficient service as well.
Sasha, looking ahead, if people are listening to this thinking, oh, right, we're going to find out more information about that, would it be the subway.com website that you would suggest they should go to?
Absolutely. We've got a full list of participating stores, and there's over 2,000 stores that are participating tomorrow for Valentine's Day. So everything's there that you need to know to find out about Customer Appreciation Day and enjoy a bit of love from Subway with a free sub.
And Mike, from the point of view of the Institute of Customer Service, is the prognosis generally good as we head towards 2017? Well, head towards 2018, really, but head through 2017?
All the signs are good. Customer service, customer satisfaction has been improving over the last 2 years, and the indications are that it's going to keep going in an upwards direction. But that doesn't mean that organisations should take their foot off the pedal and be complacent about it, because the minute that happens, satisfaction levels do drop.
Always important that one broadcasts with a smile on one's lips, really, from that perspective. And it's been a genuine delight to feature both of your good selves this morning. Mike Padruk, Head of Policy at the Institute of Customer Service, and Sasha Clark, Director of Subway UK and Ireland. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you.
Hey there, everybody. I'm filmmaker, podcaster, California State Certified Violence Prevention Specialist, and podiatrist to the stars, Phil Lairness. And I've been proud to be a U.S. cultural correspondent for Alex Lefchuk's Midweek Drive program for many years now. And I congratulate you, dear listener, on having found this oasis of podcast audio magic in the cosmos, or on your internet-equipped mobile device, or your computer, or...
Keep the engine running.
Sophie Ellis Bextor, Wild Forever. Coming up on Siren today, we have at 3 o'clock Themes and Schemes, 4 o'clock Legends on Siren FM, Drive Time, of course, between 5 and 7, and then the Stone Tapes with Sam Stone, David J. Howe, George Mann. Actually, I said David J. Howe. David J. Howe isn't on this edition of the Stone Tapes, because he was poorly when it was actually put into our system and such like. So Sam Stone, George Mann, and Patricia H. Ash, and of course from Wales, Starburst writer Robin Pearce. Late Night Siren, of course, at 10 o'clock. And then it's Jeff Thompson, I believe, with Breakfast on Siren FM. No, it isn't actually tomorrow. It's another team. Sorry, Jeff is Tuesday and Wednesdays. It's a completely different, wonderful team of folk who actually do the Breakfast show on Siren, who are so wonderful, I can't even remember their names at present. But they're all wonderful people. They are. You're sort of pointing and saying it's there.
I think it says
Kai, Maisie, Chris, Liam, Niall and Joe.
Thank you so much for that. How could I have forgotten Kai Valentine, Maisie Williams and many other fine folk with the Friday breakfast sequence between 7 and 9. Anyway, from the Roll of Honour from today's programme, thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Adrian Tchaikovsky, Sasha Clark, Mike Petruk, William Sitwell and Holly McGrattan and Natasha Armstrong and Hannah Brown. Natasha, did you enjoy your return, albeit briefly, taking the role of Ben Lewis on today's Midweek Drive Maudy edition?
It was a pleasure as always, Alex.
Well, there we are. You're back for the Midweek Drive next Wednesday, presumably?
Yes, I will be.
And Hannah, you're also back for the usual sessions next Wednesday as well?
Yep, as long as I'm not abducted by aliens.
It could happen.
Or giant lizards.
Or giant lizards.
All sorts of other things that can actually work there. That's it. We're out of here. Can we all say, have a great Thursday? After three,
have a great Thursday.